The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Hello, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition for this week. We have, as of last week at least, achieved our quest of our in our search for the fund number. But now we're doing a little follow-up, so we're still talking fund number here on the EDU show for this week. And we had talked a little bit about kind of how this whole process might be adapted to someone with a lot lower resources. We were using an example where people started with a set of deployable funds or liquid assets, we might call them, of like $2.8 million or something. We walked through that, and there's plenty of people listening who don't have those level of resources, and we'd actually gotten some questions about, you know, how could this even work, this approach, if you had much lower resources. So we originally talked about diving in today maybe with a example of how you might adjust our process, if you will. Not much adjustment. It holds true. The numbers are going to be different, but if your portfolio is much lower, maybe the sub $1 million category, there is obviously a certain point where if you have no real deployable funds, you can't start assigning them jobs. So there is a lower limit on being able to do what we do, but certainly can be done with far less than $2.8 million. However, Jim shared with me right before the show that we had a few other questions that come up and have come up that might be better to deal with first before we go on that kind of fund number 2.0 kind of conversation. So I'll invite him to come in and confirm if I've interpreted his comments properly or not.
I think you have interpreted them pretty good. I'd give you 8 stars out of 10. How's that?
Perfect. A B. I can live with that.
Oh, don't we do Rotten Tomatoes now? Isn't that how they rate movies now, Rotten Tomatoes? So you'd have 80% Rotten Tomatoes? Or is that good? Something like that.
Supposedly those are good, but doesn't sound very good when you say rotten.
Well, I don't know. It's all Rotten Tomatoes. I grew up with Siskel and Ebert with the thumbs up, thumbs down. It was so much easier than this.
Such simpler times.
It was much easier times. Much, much easier times. It's funny how we grew up with that, and nowadays kids don't even know what that is.
Makes you feel old, doesn't it?
It does make me feel old. All righty. Excuse me, folks. What we're going to do today is originally I had said we were going to dedicate the last one or two EDU shows on the fund number concept, and it's been evolving from fund number to minimum dignity floor calculations. We're getting tons of questions in on that. I think everybody can see how it all ties in, at least in our minds. There's a method to our madness in coming up with your fund number. You have to go through everything, and we'll summarize it in a second. But I started thinking, Chris, based on a couple of the email questions we got in this week, that if I was to jump into the sub $1 million portfolios right now, I'd have to jump back into some of the larger retirement reserves or retirement assets that people have, the 2.8 million, if you will. And again, that's just a random number, folks. But for the people with greater than $1 million in savings, there's still some items that I want to capture and discuss for them. So I thought, let me kind of wrap this up, hopefully today. If not, there's no time limit on these. I'll do as many as necessary to convey what we're trying to convey to you. But I think astute listeners who've been listening to us for a while are starting to see the calculation of your fund number is kind of like what's left over. It's the diesel fuel, if you will, that's left over. Isn't that what diesel is? It used to be a byproduct of the distilling process. If I understand that correctly, as you're making gas and all these other things, diesel would be left over. That's what someone told me once.
That you've caught me off guard on. I don't know the history of diesel fuel.
It's either diesel or kerosene. One of them is just kind of what's left over at the end. They got this stuff, let's make something out of it kind of thing. That's kind of where the fund number fits in almost. And if I'm not saying it's diesel fuel or kerosene. It's the aim of what we want to do. But to get the fund number, you have to do a lot of other things first. And you have to, yes, figure out your minimum dignity floor and your secure income. And if there is a shortage, and then you have to fund those shortages. And in doing those calculations to fund those shortages, you started moving dollars out of your portfolio. We shared with you that that's originally what our process was. We wanted to simply fund minimum dignity floor. So we would subtract those expenses out, and then we would have this big round portfolio again and invest it based on risk tolerance and allow clients to spend from it for all their other expenses. And we would account for fund spending by making clients fill in a very lengthy, only 5 pages, but a, to them, very difficult questionnaire and tell us what you're going to spend at 70, 71, 72, 73, 74. It was crazy. But that's the way we used to do it. And we used to then see if those withdrawals could be supported by this remaining dollars. And I shared with everybody here on the podcast where I started rethinking that with the person who wanted to buy a trailer, but wait, because he had just bought a truck, even though I knew and felt strongly he could spend all that money up front. It was freaking him out. So we wanted to start delving a little deeper, and I thought, well, if I can identify minimum dignity floor needs, why don't I identify the fund? And then to do that, you came up with the concept of see-through portfolio. We had to start withdrawing the biggest expense, in my opinion, next to the minimum dignity floor, which is aging. How are you going to cover and pay for aging? We're not getting younger, stronger, and healthier. And we talked about that on the previous shows, folks, and we started subtracting out the aging. And then it was just common sense. Well, keep going. Let's subtract out the guaranteed inheritance if that's important. Let's subtract out the buffer, the reserve, the extra money you're going to put off to the side and not touch for unplanned expenses. Let's subtract out any other expenses that individuals may have that are important to them. And eventually you get what's left is your discretionary expenses. That's how this all came about. And you should probably start to see, folks, all these things you're subtracting out of your portfolio, this big portfolio you have, 2.8 million in our hypothetical example, are the positions that when clients hire us to manage their assets in a distribution portfolio, we add a service called positioning, and it's just helping them invest all of these see-through portfolio numbers that we came up with, because they're all invested differently. Minimum dignity floor needs are invested differently than guaranteed inheritance needs, which are invested different than a long-term care reserve, which are invested differently than go-go fund spending, which is invested differently than slow-go and no-go fund spending. They all have different investment purposes, in our opinions, so they should all be invested differently based on the risk capacity of those expenses, which again is pretty much a time segmented measure of when are you going to need those dollars. The sooner you need them, the less risky they can be. The longer you need them, theoretically, the more risky they can be. So you can start to see how this all ties in and falls into place and ultimately came up with the fund number. And then what do we do with it? And when I started contemplating talking to people with a sub $1 million portfolio, which you can see is going to lead to a relatively small fund number, it dawned on me that we often run into people who also have the opposite issue. So I thought before I get into sub $1 million portfolios, just want to give a shout out that some of you, as you start to calculate your fund number, may end up with a number, Chris, that they're going to look at and think what?
There's no way in heck I'm ever going to spend all that.
Yes, on fun.
Right.
They just don't see it. And that happens to us quite often. I won't say every single day or every single month, but we do run into people who end up having fund numbers that they just don't conceptually envision themselves spending. And it's not all multi-million dollar fund numbers. We have had people with $500,000, $600,000, $800,000, maybe a $1.2 million fund number, who have all shared with us over the years, that's too much. They're not going to spend it. I remember one client in particular, a local client from Colorado, I won't say where, but they live in the state of Colorado, live very modestly on Social Security and savings, and were in better financial condition than other clients that we know of with seven-figure portfolios, all because they lived well within their means. And they had a quote-unquote fund number of just a few $100,000. And they were totally content with that and didn't think they would be able to spend it all. Now, Medicaid played a huge role in their calculation for aging, and they knew that. They knew that going into everything. But we'll talk about not necessarily those people in particular, but we'll talk about those situations later, and I promise we will. But for those of you who may walk through all the calculations and you come up with a fund number, if it seems big and you just don't conceptually see you spending all that money now, what do you do? What do you do there? You know, you're the coyote. You caught the roadrunner. You got it. You got this fund number, and you're starting to think, well, gee, it's actually bigger than what I feel it should be or could be or feel that I could spend. Then some of the things we do are we talk to our clients about. Should we move some more assets from the fund number to any other positions? Are you truly satisfied with the other positions that take precedence above the fund number? Do you have enough for aging reserve or guaranteed inheritance? Or maybe you never had a guaranteed inheritance and you want to build one in there. Or, and I don't have children, but I know many people do. In fact, most people do. I'm the anomaly. But do you really want to wait then to death to give assets away? You have your guaranteed inheritance. We have that squirreled away. We have that invested appropriately, or you do if you're your own asset manager. You've squirreled it away. You've identified it. You've invested it appropriately as a guaranteed inheritance, which means it probably has more of a growth tilt to it. You don't need any hedging or buffering in those assets. Just invest it for growth and for your risk tolerance, but ideally for the risk tolerance of someone much younger who's going to inherit it. But if you have that taken care of, you could still start giving money away. Not necessarily to charities, unless that does bring joy to you, but I mean to some children or grandchildren. And we've had clients who've done that, have they not, Chris? Mm-hmm. We've pointed out to them, you could actually start giving some away. which, if you think about it, Chris and listeners, is fun. Fun number is money spent on discretionary spending. Spending that you can legitimately say, no, I don't want to do that. And no one is going to suffer an economic or financial hardship. Now, granted, the recipient of the gift might say, well, gee, if you don't give it to me, I will suffer an economic or financial hardship. I'll concede that. But you're not going to suffer an economic, financial, and I used to say medical hardship if you don't cover a fun expense. That, to me, is the definition of a discretionary expense. But if you don't cover food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care, you or someone dependent on you will suffer an economic, financial, or medical hardship. Totally different expense. So you might not think gifting money to a charity or to a child is fun in the traditional sense, but I think for many people it would be, especially to a child, to see the joy as they spend your gift on something and they share with you what they're doing with it rather than telling it to you over your gravestone or over the ocean as they're sprinkling your ashes somewhere. Anything you want to add on that little tidbit, Chris? That
Yeah, I usually call it an advanced inheritance because it's ultimately going to go to the same people you'd give it to if you passed away, but why not have some joy during your lifetime, seeing the positive effects it might have on your beneficiaries, you know, whoever it might be, it doesn't even have to be family. If you truly don't anticipate needing that money for your own use, I joke all the time with people, someone's going to spend the money. If you've decided somebody else is going to spend the money because you have no intention of doing so, and you've got nice, robust protections and all of the other areas that you're concerned about, and you truly have some that is quote left over, consider doing it while you're still alive, seeing the effects of what you've done. And you might find, particularly with kids growing up, certainly it's going to be impactful, even if they get it late in life, maybe at their own retirement, that'll be impactful for them. But think about all the times growing up and as they grew up and aged through different phases of life, if they had a little additional funds to make a little better choice or a little, you know, give them more flexibility or something, that has kind of a compounding effect. We talk about compounding growth of, you know, financial compounding when people invest and there's growth over time. But think about an investment in someone who could use a little leg up in a certain area, help, you know, funding to be able to move and take a different job or build a house or, you know, who knows what, could be anything. And then the new trajectory that life is on after you do that can be very impactful. So certainly worth considering. Not everyone has enough to consider, gee, this amount I can't imagine ever spending on myself. So, it'd be fine whether we give it away or we hold it and give it away at death. So that's the other nice thing about the fund number is it can help identify some of those funds for people who are too scared to give it away while living. And they take the typical approach, which is hold on to it till we're sure we don't need it. And the sure we don't need it day is the day we die. It doesn't necessarily have to be that day. I think you can be relatively comfortable as long as you take a well-reasoned and well-thought-out approach to all the other things you might want to protect against and truly find some money that may not have a job in your lifetime that you could give away.
And for those of you who don't want to give it away, part of what we also do, and I never mentioned this, you don't have to position everything around the fun number. What do I mean by that? You've got your big portfolio. We've been using 2.8 as the example. I don't remember the exact amounts. I'm trying to find my notes here in front of me, but there they are. You subtracted $800,000 out for minimum dignity floor in our example, $400,000 out for aging-related expenses, $500,000 out for your guaranteed inheritance, and $300,000 for a quote-unquote buffer, leaving an $800,000 fund number. Let's just say that person felt there's no way I'm going to spend more than a couple of hundred thousand in my go-go years and maybe one or 200,000 more in slow and no-go. We just don't do enough. We don't want to. We don't want you to think, wow, I'm going to have this big, fun number that I now have to invest. You can make the fun number anything you want it to be as long as it's smaller. So in 800,000, let's just say the people think, Jim, I'm not going to spend more than 200,000 on my go-go phase, and let's reserve another 200,000 for the slow-go and no-go phase. We would take, if we were working with them, we would take the remaining 400,000 in this example, and we categorize it as non-positioned asset. That's what we call it in the office. And it's literally just what it sounds. It is not a positioned asset. It is an accumulation, a growth asset. In our opinion, we have to confer with the client and make sure we understand their risk tolerance to investing. But it's non-categorized. It's non-positioned. It's not earmarked for any particular spending. You don't necessarily have to make it your quote-unquote fun number. We, if people don't want to add it to the fun number and gift it or do something with it, we just save it. We just keep it there. And we generally invest it based on the risk tolerance of the person, not the risk capacity. And there's a difference there. Everything else, every other position, is viewed through its risk capacity. When do we anticipate needing to spend that money? That's what risk capacity is looking at. That's why they call it capacity. What is the capacity of that asset to withstand a loss? And you base it off of the time you think it's going to be before you need it. If someone is telling us these extra assets, remember the analogy I once used, Chris, for doing Roth conversions? We used to use a cup of flour and we put a knife across the top to get the exact measurement. Well, these assets, the cup of flour is your whole positioning plan, and you just scraped your knife across that cup of flour, and all that flour that's dropping is this extra $400,000 in my hypothetical example to you. These are dollars that truly are not needed. The cup is full. This is floweth over. And it has nothing to do with 2.8 million being the starting number. I am not kidding you. With a sub $1 million client, they had a fund number that they felt they would never spend. So a lot of it comes down to lifestyle, not necessarily dollars. Although Chris and I will concede, most people who have non-positioned assets, the leftover money, have portfolios bigger than a million or two. We will concede that, but not all of them. So if you fall into this category, what do you do? To us, those should be invested based on your risk tolerance, not necessarily your risk capacity. And if your risk tolerance is moderate or moderately aggressive, go ahead and invest them that way. These are dollars that you truly don't need. We would tell you they have a moderate to high risk capacity merely because they're not earmarked for any spending. And in our opinion, they're going to be part of the inheritance. But we also have to pay, and you have to pay attention to the emotional volatility of portfolios as you age and they're dropping. So you would want to invest it based on your risk capacity. Or you may want to invest it in assets that you might not normally have thought about buying. Maybe you want to invest passively in a business, maybe a pizza shop down the street. These are some dollars that you could do that with. Maybe you always wanted to get into, I don't want to start naming assets, but y'all can figure it out. There's all these new alternative assets that people want to play around with. You could take it from that. Maybe you didn't want to invest it at all. You wanted to use it as a loan to someone or do some of that. What do they call it there where you can make loans to people? I don't know. There's websites that do that. You can do anything you want with these non-positioned assets. There's no right or wrong answer, in my opinion. They are truly not needed. We don't necessarily mean for you to just to go get rid of them, but you can do other things with them. You don't have to make it part of the fun number, is my point. You can truly have non-positioned excess assets. You came down to what the fun number is, and it's so big, you're only going to reserve a portion of it. The rest of the assets you can go do something else with and feel a little more at ease that if this investment or that investment or this loan or this business you're going to take part in doesn't quite make it, it's not going to cause you, hopefully, to ruin the success of your retirement. That you were evaluating everything and you did the see-through portfolio and you pulled the positions out. You came up with your fun number. You agreed to yourselves that it's too big and we're happier with this smaller number, and you just have these extra dollars. Some people also will just keep it as part of their fun number. They just have us put it more towards the slow go, the slow go and the no go phase, where we tend to take more growth orientated approaches with that, depending on how far away slow go and no go may be. You could also keep it in something like that. The choices are limitless. It's whatever works for you. I just wanted to get some people to understand, Chris, it is conceptual that your fun number might be to a level where it's more than you're going to spend. And I just wanted to give a few thoughts on that. Does that make sense?
Yes? Yeah, no? I think that was good to touch on. Yeah.
Anything you want to add to that?
No. I think we covered that pretty well.
Okay. So we have received, folks, a lot of emails, and we're going to dedicate the next few Q&A shows to the emails that we received on fund number. So if you have any questions and you haven't sent them in, feel free to do that. But some of these questions did get me thinking and wanted to bring up a few more items as we just kind of finalize and wrap up the concept of the fun number. And one of the things that people were asking about, Chris, and maybe you can adjust for it, and we'll get into it deeper on the Q&A show too, they were wondering how we adjust for taxes in the fun number. Do you want to opine on that? Recognizing, yeah. We'll probably get into it a little deeper, or if we get into it deep enough here, we won't answer the individual questions. But we got a few on that. A couple of people saying, hey, where do I fit taxes into my fun number?
Well, I'd say the way I describe it, and I would encourage you to think about it, is the fun number is a gross number. That's how much is available at face value, we'll call it, if you looked up your account balances. That's really the fun number in its dollar value form. And that may or may not result in a similar amount of spending. And that's because when you go to spend it, you have to take it from where it's being stored in that account, whatever that account might be. And there might be some tax ramifications to that distribution before you can actually go spend it. So $1 million worth of, I'll say it this way. On one hand, $1 million worth of a fund number may only generate $800,000 or $700,000 of actual spending if you were to factor in taxes. However, that's, thinking of it that way is a little too simplistic, which makes it difficult to adjust for this, is where I'm going with this, in that you're not going to pull it all out at once. So that $1 million actually has potential to grow over time, at least the portion of that fund number that you're not spending immediately. And so the actual spending would grow up because of that growth potential in the future, which would kind of offset the reduction that we just made in taxes. So I think for most people, if they have a reasonable mix of accounts, if all your money's in always taxable, it can be pretty easy to adjust for taxes to determine how much after-tax spending you might have from that gross amount. But if you've got a mixture of things, it's just a good starting point. But in particular, the money you're going to spend soon in the go-go period, if you want to be sure to have X amount of dollars to spend in the first 5 years, that you need to take a nice close look at. You're obviously going to position those dollars in something that doesn't have a lot of growth potential, and those dollars are going to be used right away, and therefore the tax ramifications of the distributions for those need to be taken into consideration. And if you want to be sure to have, you know, fill in the X, I said X, you know, $150,000 worth of spending on fun over the next 3 years, you've got to make sure there's enough positioned there to handle the taxes and leave you with $150,000 to actually go spend. The longer term stuff, there's so many moving parts, it gets difficult to make a direct adjustment there. But it is true, and I'm glad people pointed this out, that the fun number concept that we walked you through gets you to a gross figure that might have more or less tax ramifications needing of adjustment, depending on your specific circumstances and the mixture of accounts you've got and what tax brackets you're typically in, how much other income you've got regularly from maybe Social Security and pensions. There's lots of variables here, but it's there. The other thing that's probably bothering people is, well, if you can't, you know, you got to write as complicated a spreadsheet as possible to try to figure this out down to the dollar. This process will never get you to exactly a precise number. This is get you a ballpark and really to empower you to position an appropriate amount in these different time horizons and risk tolerance sleeves that we've been kind of describing. It's never going to be precise to the dollar or $10 or even hundreds of dollars. It's going to be, as long as you're in the right ballpark, it's going to be way better than you just winging it, playing it by the seat of your pants. So also keep that in mind. There's really no practical way to get this dialed into the dollar.
Right. So a couple of strategies that I want everyone to think of. And it's how everything ties in. And that's one of the things that we want to start getting people to understand. Not even with minimum daily floor, secure income, fun number, go-go, slow-go, no-go spending, all of these concepts that we have, that we believe in. But in general, don't become so dogmatic in taking just fun from the fun reserve when the time comes. And what do I mean by that? So some of the things that we have to look at when we do our planning, when we initially are trying to get the conceptual, the visualization of what all of this is going to look like for a person that we're working with. So we're trying to come up with their minimum dignity floor, the secure incomes, the shortages, things of that nature. Some of the things we'll build in are required minimum distributions. But actually, before I get to that, one of the things that we have to look at and one of the things you need to pay attention to is your tax diversification. So you have your fun number. You caught the coyote. The roadrunner. You're the coyote. You caught the roadrunner. You got it. And we said, what the hell do you do with it? Well, you should look at your tax diversification. How much do you have in always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable? Some of you, most of you, a lot of you have all of your money or a good chunk of your money in always taxable retirement accounts. 70, 80, 90% of your money in always taxable retirement accounts. So your ultimate positioning, and I don't want to use I mean that in a different sense than positioning that we do, but the ultimate accounts that you're going to put these different investments in, your choices are very limited. If you have 90% of your money in IRAs, most of your spending is going to be in IRA accounts. However, if you have some modestly good tax diversification, even if it's amongst only two different tax style accounts, maybe you have always taxable and never taxable. Gee, I got 30% of my money in Roth and 70% of my money in an IRA. Or maybe it's a brokerage account. You got 30% and 70% in an IRA and none in a Roth. Whatever the case may be, if you have your money in well diversified in two or three of the three styles, you need to also start paying attention to what accounts your fund number is put in. Same thing with your aging reserves and your guaranteed inheritances and your buffer reserve and minimum dignity floor needs. This is going to turn into more of a tax discussion, so I want to save it. Maybe this will be a whole other series of EDUs. But when it comes to just fund number, because that's what we're looking at here, just fund number, one of the things that we'll do because of taxes, and especially because we don't limit people once we come up with the fund number to a certain spending value every year. We may begin by asking them, in a best case scenario, how much do you think you're going to spend in any given year? I told you we begin with that. We multiply that by two, and that result, that multiplication by two, becomes the liquidity that we're looking to maintain throughout our relationship with the people. But all those other dollars, especially if they have good tax diversification, we now, and you, even if you don't have the dollars that we're talking here, every distribution, you need to be looking at what account to take it from. That's called a withdrawal analysis. And that plays into the fund number in this gentleman's discussion of where do you adjust for taxes. One of the reasons we don't reduce it down for taxes is we don't know what people are going to pay in any given year on taxes. Even if they had 90% of their money in always taxable accounts, we don't know what future tax rates are going to be. But if you have always, maybe, and never accounts, we like to have enough money in a perfect world. All of your spending needs that are in addition to your guaranteed income. So any minimum dignity floor items that we have to cover that are not being covered by secure income and all your fun, those dollars in a perfect world are going to be in a bank account already. And if not there, we're going to try to get them there when you retire. So you have this liquid bank account with $100,000 or $200,000 in it. Most of the people we work with will have that. $100,000, $200,000, $250,000 or so thousand in a bank. If they don't have it, we try to get it for them. Why are we trying to do that? Just so they can spend to their heart's content and not worry about taxes yet. It's all after-tax dollars they're spending. Then, every October and November, we reach out to those people. We talk to them. If we haven't been communicating with them throughout the year, if they're what we call an a la carte client and they haven't contacted us, we may not even know what's happening. If they're working with us on a regular basis, we probably have that info already. But we'll chat with them. We'll touch base with them. This is a tax discussion we're having. We look at all the income that they've achieved that year. What did you get in Social Security? What did you get in pension? What did you get in an annuity? Did you work any part-time? Did you do any consulting? Did you have any deferred income come in? Royalties? Who knows what it can be? Inheritances? We get told all sorts of different things. And what Bob is trying to do in the office is see what is their potential tax liability right now? And then we also ask them about that money in the bank. How is that holding out? Do you conceptually have enough to cover next year's expenses? We will pull what our software projects they're going to need for next year in addition to their secure income. and we'll review that with them. Well, we're showing that you might need an additional $58,000 to cover this, 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 and these. How does that look to you? Reasonable, not? If it's reasonable and they still have ample money in their bank account that we feel their required expenses, the secure income needs, and their desired expenses, the fund, is available in liquid cash, what we then start to do is figure out, is there any way to optimize their taxes this year, top off on a certain bracket or anticipate future brackets increasing like they will in 2026? And instead of taking those dollars out of their account and putting it in the bank, we put it in a Roth as a conversion if it's inside an IRA or a 401k. We do these proactive conversions. But when money goes into a Roth, some of that, in our opinion, is still going to be spent on fun at some point. And we leave some money in a Roth relatively safe in cash-like holdings. I won't get into every cash-like holding. It's not literally cash. We call it cash-like holdings. And why do we do that, folks? Same thing these people have been asking us. How do you adjust for taxes? In a perfect world, if we can have all your money in an after-tax bank account for the year, or even a little bit more than a year, it allows you to do some very detailed tax planning every year. And maybe, just maybe, there'll come a time where Bob or a future CPA says, well, wait a minute, guys. Here's a client contacts us, wants to do a $70,000 new car. I want to buy my daughter a new car. She needs a new car. She got into an accident the other day. I just want a $70,000 Volvo. It's the safest car out there. We can get calls like that. We do get calls like that. And they just want the money. Now there might not be enough in that bank account. Nobody expected the daughter to get into an accident and they need it. So they call us. So when we do their positioning for fun, we always go out of our way to put a little bit of fun in each of their tax diversification. Always, maybe, never. Especially in maybe and never. Because most people have the majority in always. We try to always get some in maybe and never. Why? So when you have one of these unexpected expenses, or it could be a planned expense, we can look from a tax perspective, and maybe the perfect tax optimization is to take 50% of it from the IRA, 20% as basis from the brokerage account, and maybe not basis, long-term cap gain is a better example, and 30% of the money needs to come out of a Roth because that could push into another bracket and be taxed at a higher level. So that's one of the reasons we don't look at fun and reduce it for taxes. We just tell people this is a gross number. But I don't know what you're going to spend on taxes, because proper planning is to manage your withdrawals. This ties to fun and every other expense as well. If someone was to call us, Chris, and say, hey, there's been an emergency or something like that, and we need some money from our buffer. We need a new roof. That was what someone's question was, and we'll get to it on one of the EDU shows. Where do you account for unexpected major expenses like a new roof or a new HVAC system in your house, a heating and air conditioning system in your house? How do you account for that? That can be tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of dollars. He rhetorically answered the question by saying, is it the buffer? Well, yes, it normally would be the buffer. But what, folks, what if the buffer asset was invested? Because we have some people telling us they don't anticipate needing it for a while. They want to invest it. A lot of people are loath to keep anything or as minimal as possible in principal protection. And what if the investment is down? Everyone knows we shouldn't access it. But, well, gee, Jim, that's the position I'm supposed to go to. It's my heating and air conditioning system needs replacing. I'm not going to take it from fun. It's not fun for me to spend on that. No, but the fund may have the liquidity, and I'm not going to have to sell something that's down. So don't be dogmatic on these positions. The idea of positioning and fund number calculation is to see through your portfolio, break the assets up. But when the time comes, you have to look from an investment standpoint, if it makes sense selling that position, and from a tax standpoint, what account does it make sense to spend from? Maybe it's going to make sense to spend from a Roth IRA for fun in a given year, and you earmarked that Roth for a guaranteed inheritance. But from the tax standpoint, if you took it from the brokerage account or the IRA, it's going to cause your taxes to go up quite substantially. Well, gee, there's a conundrum there, Jim, but oh well, I guess I have no choice. That's where the position is. No. You go to the Roth position, the guaranteed inheritance. Maybe that has enough profit in it where we can take the money from that without hurting the portfolio. We're going to sell something up, not down. It's going to help you from a tax standpoint. And then when the correct position inside your IRA from a tax standpoint, this is probably a bad example I'm giving because you could have done this as a conversion, but when it comes time, then you can take the money from the IRA and replace it to the Roth, or replace it from the IRA to the brokerage account if that's where it is. Don't follow the logic of what I'm saying, not the way I described it. What I'm getting at is at times we raid, quote unquote, raid a position for a need that it was not originally earmarked for. And then we'll note as we do this for people. That's why we call it convenience portfolios. You pay us to do it. If you're doing it yourself, you note it somewhere. That you took money from a position for a non-positioned need. You most likely took it from a tax perspective or an investment perspective. And when the correct position becomes available from a tax or investment standpoint, you replace the dollars. And you don't have to physically move them into that account. You can just change the positioning, which is what we do when we track this. We use Excel to track a lot of this. So we'll program that into the Excel spreadsheet that we created, giving us a note that, hey, this position over here, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 of it is actually right now being earmarked for this position over there. Does that kind of make sense where I'm getting with that, Chris? That taxes are so dynamic and investments are so dynamic. Don't look at this as being dogmatic. You have to be willing to give and take on this. And don't hesitate to take from one position to fund another position because it makes sense to do so from a tax perspective. Just keep a note of it and eventually you'll get it back in. And the reason we believe in this is what the IRS always says about money. What do they say about it, Chris?
Dollars are fungible.
Money is fungible. To the IRS, it doesn't matter where the dollars come from. It's all fungible. And your spending should be the same way. You're going to create these positions to come up with your fund number. You're going to invest the positions appropriately and in the right tax diversification. But fund, try to break it up into all of your tax diversifications that you have. Always, maybe, never taxable. If you have all three, there should be fun in all three. If you have just one, obviously your fund's in just one. If you have two, break it up into two. And in a perfect world, try to have a year or more of spending in the bank. And just spend to your heart's content. and figure it all out in October, November, December. We usually start late October, beginning of November, when we start looking at this for people and trying to determine if we should do any select conversions, if we should do any withdrawals, should we pull any spending from for next year into this tax year? Should we pull that? And if we did, if it makes sense, and this is something that Chris chats a lot about, and he can add chime in. But if it turns out that, yes, it would make sense to pull some spending into this year, and a lot of your money is in always taxable IRAs, we don't recommend you just pull that money out. We recommend you convert it. And why is that, Chris?
Well, then you've got it. If you don't end up spending it, you've got it housed in the beauty of a Roth account, so any future growth is tax-free.
Absolutely. So when we do the analysis, even if you have always taxable money, and even if Roth conversions aren't a normal strategy for you, it's still something that needs to be evaluated every year. Because it may make sense to say, oh, well, wait a minute. Yeah, I can't convert. I need this money to spend. But wow, you didn't spend enough this year. You got room in this bracket. Let's pull some of this money out. Let's fill that bracket. Well, we would still recommend you fill it as a conversion and not just a withdrawal. Because if you don't need to spend it, it's there inside the Roth. And if you do need to spend it, no big deal. We can keep money inside a Roth very safe. You can put it in an FDIC-insured three-month CD if you wanted and keep rolling three-month CDs. You can keep it very safe. It's not a big deal. So these are the types of things we look at, not only as we manage a fund number, but an entire positioning plan. Because that's the fund number is just the net result of a sound positioning plan. It's the last thing in that see-through portfolio. Taxes, we don't reduce it for taxes. We try to manage the taxes by evaluating what account fund should come from every year. But in a perfect world, in an easy world for you, just get enough money in the bank and just distribute from that and figure it out every fall. For those DIYers, you'll do that every fall yourself. If you work with a firm, have them do it. But it should be looked at every fall before the end of the year. And hopefully you can control the taxation on that fund and every other position as well. Anyways, I hope that all made sense. I know I kind of rambled there, but this isn't a set it and forget it. I told everybody listening to this podcast over the years, accumulation planning is the easy phase. And I would argue, and I know people hate when I say that in our industry, Chris, I would argue you don't need an investment advisor. You need a financial planner during your accumulation years. People in their 20s and 30s and 40s have all sorts of financial planning needs and things that they have to look at. I question the value of an investment advisor, and I'm sure most of you do-it-yourselfers agree that a well-diversified, passive portfolio, low-cost, rebalanced annually or semi-annually is perfect. And you don't need active management, although I will concede some of the strategies, especially in technology or healthcare or other alternatives or something like that, some active management may help. But for the most part, passive management is all you need. But in distribution is where you probably need help, not only a financial planner, but a sound investment advisor who can track a lot of this for you and help you do a lot of this. The unfortunate thing is most investment advisors simply want to keep one round portfolio, limit you to a safe withdrawal rate, charge their asset under management fee on top of it, and do precious little, if not outsource it to a third-party asset manager who's going to do all the managing, and they're just scraping 1% out of it for something. I don't know what. But I do feel in distribution, because it's so complex, because you have to look at the tax implications, the tax diversification, the required minimum distribution rules, you have to take all of this into account every single year and manage all these different positions separately based on their risk capacity. Eventually, you might get to the point where you might not be able to do this. That's all I'm getting at. It's complex. We admit it. But I think right now, most of you can pretty much handle this. But maybe at some point in the future, you may have to pass this on. Just be receptive to that. I know you do-it-yourselfers love to do it yourself. That's why you call do-it-yourselfers. And this isn't a shout-out to hire us. Everybody knows we're not accepting new clients. But what I'm saying is at a point in time, you may need to look for some help. Anything you want to add on that as we wrap this up?
No, I think you kind of captured all the moving parts that people should be considering in this. But and I'll just emphasize one thing you said. Don't be too rigid or dogmatic. That just because you set it up one way, there can be every reason in the world that in any given year you might do something a little differently, and then you adjust from there. It's kind of rolling with the punches. You know, set yourself up to be as prepared as possible, but then roll with the punches. I think that's probably the most reasonable way to deal with retirement.
Absolutely. Everybody knows in the office, one of my pet peeve sayings is when somebody says, that's the way we've always done it. Oh, that grates on my nerves. Because even as a firm, we roll with the punches, as Chris says. And the way we do things today is different than the way we did them just a couple of years ago. And the way we'll be doing it 10 years from now will probably look dramatically different than the way we do it today. Things improve, strategies change, ideas come about. Be receptive to that as well in your management and in your fun number calculation. Be very fluid. Don't overanalyze. Try to figure out where every single expense comes from. We got a couple of questions on that. Where does this expense come from? Where does that expense come from? How do you account for this? We'll get into them in the Q&A show. Those people are overthinking this. And some said, well, these expenses aren't fun, so I don't want to take it from my fun number. Well, don't. But we'll chat about that after. There's many expenses that will happen that aren't necessarily in a category or in a position, and they'll come out of the fund. One of them was, how do you account for the expenses I pay my financial planner and investment advisor? And that was a good one. We'll chat with that. He said, paying that is not fun. I get that. Maybe not every single expense is fun when you do it, but the fun number is kind of the catch-all for a discretionary expense. You could either build an expense like that into your minimum dignity floor, absolutely, if you know what your advisor is going to be charging you all the time, or your CPA or whatever, that just becomes a professional fee. And it can absolutely be built into the minimum dignity floor. We would have nothing against that if it's part of your lifestyle. But if it's not, yes, it comes from the fun, even though it's not really fun spending on that. Does that make sense, Chris?
Yeah, I think I always, this falls into the category that I always have to remind people of what the minimum dignity floor is meant. In our definition, it's those expenses that you want to absolutely make sure are covered, even if you ran out of assets. I would propose that management fees, the fees you pay your financial advisor, are discretionary. Everyone can choose to make it part of their minimum dignity floor, but are you really saying we want to make sure to pay our financial advisor even if we ran completely out of money?
True.
My guess is that's no for most people. Some people maybe it's yes, but keep that in mind. The purpose of the minimum dignity floor is to establish that floor that you need to maintain even if you ran out of money and were living just on your secure income. When you look at it like that, a lot of people that start to think about adding a few things to their minimum dignity floor, they realize, no, you're right. Those are discretionary expenses. We're going to fund them, but they're going to come out of that discretionary bucket instead. Now, some people have way too much secure income. So they've got secure income that just naturally covers a bunch of discretionary expenses. And I could see where advisory fees and things can be paid out of there, but it's not, we're not juicing up or growing your minimum dignity floor for that purpose. It's just that you happen to have secure income that covers a lot of those things. Now, everyone can define their minimum dignity floor concept on their own. If you want to throw in a bunch of expenses that we don't and you want to make it part of your floor, what you're doing is creating a situation that generates a greater need for secure income, which would might then imply that you're going to turn more of your liquid assets into annuitized income, which is totally fine. If that's the floor you want to build that's higher than the floor that we propose you build, it's your plan. You can do it. Totally fine. If you feel better about it, go for it. But that's not quite the way we look at it.
So it's very fluid. That's the whole point, folks. And make it whatever works for you. It doesn't have to follow our beliefs to the T. This is just how we've been doing it. It's how we like it. It's works for us and works for the people who like to work with us. But you can make it anything you want it to be. Just pay attention to the positioning, especially for fun, because it's going to come every year, should be an always, maybe, and never if you have that kind of tax diversification. But that's it. We'll wrap that up. Mm-hmm. Next week, we will get into the sub $1 million portfolios because there are some unique planning things that we have to take into account as you work on developing your fund number. So we're going to help people with sub $1 million portfolios come up with their fund number and unique things they have to think of as they do that. Anything else you want to add, Chris?
No, that's it. Okay. Thank everybody again for listening. And Hope you like the fund number idea because we're spending a bunch of shows on it. But I think it's a key element to what we promote people think about for a fulfilling retirement. And so take what you want to fit into your particular plan, and you know, dismiss the part of what we say that isn't all that interesting to you. And hopefully you can get some net value out of it. And we'll.
And we'll dedicate the next couple of EDU shows, Q&A shows to the fund number. We have more than enough to do one, maybe one and a half shows already, Chris.
Okay.
So if anybody else wants, make sure you put in the subject line, a fund number question or something like that. And I think maybe the next two Q&A shows at least we'll dedicate to the fund number and then get this all wrapped up.
Okay. That email, if you want to send it in, you're a new listener, jim@jimhelps.com is the email address. That's jim@jimhelps.com. And in the subject line, indicate question about the fund number, something like that. Thanks, everybody. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.